Right, the words non-commutative, high-dimensional, local to global problems come from an article by Attia about mathematics in the 20th century, which has recently been published. And in this article, he thinks these are very important features of 20th century mathematics, but the words category or groupoid do not occur in the article, which I think is interesting. Now, I should say what I'm going to talk about today is work done with Philip Higgins in 1974 to 1973. So it's actually quite old. So one of the questions you might ask is, why talk about it today? Well, there are three reasons. One is to publicize some not so well-known methods and tools of this linear theory. I'll explain that later. And I hope to get reactions from workers at this conference. And in fact, I've just started a book project. Well, it's actually been going for a while, but we've just got support from the Lieberhulme Foundation for this book project on crossed complexes and homotopy groupoids, giving a full account of this material accessible to postgraduate students as a novel account of basic algebraic topology and some of the cohomology of groups. And so I really want to try out some of the ideas. And the final thing that occurred to me recently was that this year is actually the 20th anniversary of my first correspondence with Alexander Grothendieck, when, because Jack Duskin had informed me that Grothendieck was interested in N categories, I wrote to him and said, I've got this material, I'm interested in N categories, can I come and see you? And he said, well, I don't think I'm out of things, it wouldn't be all that useful, but I've got these letters I wrote to Larry Breen, would you like to see a copy of them? Things went on from there, and an extended correspondence led to his producing, in reaction to the material I'd sent him, Pursuing Stacks, and whose influence you all know. In fact, one of his letters to me later on said he tried to persuade his students to do non-abelian cohomology, and none of them would do it, so finally he got mad and decided to do it himself. So you can ask yourself whether he has in fact done it, but that's another question. Okay, so now the next slide, which I'll have to go over quite slowly, actually gives the main results that I'm going to talk about today, or just some of them. So you've got three categories. Where's the pen? F-top, so that's the easy one, that's filtered topological spaces. So that's just a space X infinity with a chain of subspaces. And what we're saying is that there are two functors from filter F-top. I think actually, that's all right. One of them goes to crossed complexes, which people I have to explain. Another one goes to cubical omega groupoids with connections, which I have to explain. One of the major algebraic features, which I won't say much about today, is the fact that these two categories are equivalent. The functor from the cubical stuff to the cross complex is in fact quite easy to define. It just says that in these cubical things, you have something which is much smaller and which looks like a cross complex. The real problem is to come backwards, and that actually needs these connections, which a lot of people won't be familiar with. So there are adjoint equivalences, and there are adjoint equivalences actually of monoidal closed categories, which puts quite a lot of extra structure. A further point is that rho and pi are homotopical functors. By that I mean that they're actually defined in terms of maps of geometric things, cubes or disks, into the filtered space. And so if you calculate anything of these, then you're actually calculating something about homotopy theory. Also, these functors preserve certain co-limits, and what certain means I won't be able to explain too specifically, but it's certainly adequate to do quite a lot of calculations. It also preserves certain tensor products, and the other point is that gamma, when you go from here to here, gamma of rho give you pi, so you know exactly the relationship between them. So I mentioned here that I'm talking about the linear theory, because filtered spaces are kind of linear, cross complexes are linear. So I do a lot of work with load A, which is about squares and cubes. I'm not going to say anything about that today. So what is a cross complex? Well, a cross complex is like a chain complex, except that C2 to C1 is a cross module, and actually it's a cross module of groupoids. So there's been some talk about cross module, but actually there's a lot to be said for cross modules of groupoids. And for the geometry we want to do, we do apply it to a simplex. Simplex has got lots of base points. We certainly want to have the groupoids. And for the monoidal, for the closed structure, having groupoids is absolutely essential, because the objects of the internal harm will in fact be the morphisms. So you certainly want the groupoid structure. And in dimensions greater than or equal to 3, they're all operator groups over C2 over C1 over the image of C2. But I'm not going to give a precise definition here. But that's the sort of idea. Now, so the first question is, why do you want to use cross complexes? Well, one thing is they generalize groupoids and cross modules at the same time. So both of those are known to be useful. They're also good for modeling CW complexes. And the reason for that, of course, is that if you have a CW complex, you have a filtration by Skeletor, and so you can take the cross complex associated with it. And that's quite a useful model of the CW complex. It's not a complete model, obviously, for a general CW complex. This is the linear theory. It only gives a fragment of homotopy theory. And in fact, when you look at Grothendieck's letter to Quillen, he said, you know, the problem with all this Ronnie Brown stuff is that it doesn't capture all homotopy types. So therefore, you know, we'd better try and do all these other funny things I'm thinking about, weak infinity categories, and try and really capture homotopy types. But of course, in any branch of mathematics, there may be, it may be convenient to study special cases and find it much easier to deal with as an approach to the general theory. Another important point is that free cross resolutions enable calculations with small CW models of KG1s. That is, if your CW complex is actually a K pi 1, then it turns out that the pi of that is a free cross resolution of the group, and it's actually a very good algebraic model of the group, in the sense that because of results of Whitehead, Wall, and Bowers, if you're given a free cross resolution, you can actually construct a CW complex whose cells are in 1-1 correspondence with the elements of the free basis. And Bowers has a statement which I find very difficult to follow the proof, haven't tried too hard, which says that this also works for maps, so that a map of free cross resolutions can actually be realized by a map of the CW complexes. And this actually gives you a method of calculation, because if you say, I want to define a map from this KG1 to that KH1, you know, I've got this 17-dimensional cell, I want to say exactly how it's going to be mapped. You have to divide it into little pieces and say, well, so those little pieces are actually mapped over. You know, it's a bit ridiculous. But if you're given a free cross resolution, you say, oh, well, I've got a basis, you know, a basis of 23 elements, and each of those bases I have to say how it's mapped over. It turns out that this particular basis element is mapped into a sum of 23 elements. Well, never mind, but you can actually write it down, you know. Whereas to do the corresponding geometry, you know, you just can't imagine it. So this is a very subtle theorem, and this result of Bowers that the maps are all so modeled is quite important. I wish I had a really nice elementary proof. There are also linear models of homotopy types. I won't explain. What I mean by that is the cross complexes have no quadratic information. Okay? Of course, there's a nice conjecture which says if you want the quadratic, what you need is cross complexes in the category of cross complexes, because those are double cross complexes. So the nice thing was that cubic information is modeled by triple cross complexes, but I have no guarantees about that. They're linear models, but that actually includes all homotopy 2 types, which include the information about the fundamental group. So we've actually used this to calculate second homotopy groups of 2 complexes and get some kind of algorithm in relation to the presentation which the 2 complex defines. So you can actually calculate with these things, and in particular you can do that because of this freeness. Because if you're just working with 3 elements, then you don't really need to know what are the rules. All you just say, how does this element map? You know, every so often you need to remind yourself of what the rules are. So that's one reason for not giving all the axioms. They're close to chain complexes with a groupoid of operators. That's one of the things that Whitehead made very clear in combinatorial homotopy 2. And they're related to some classical homological algebra, namely chains of syzygies in the non-commutative case. And of course there is actually a tradition of using analogues of cross complexes in homological algebra due to Gerstenhaber, Froelich, Liu, in which you actually represent cohomology groups by cross resolutions. The monoidal structure is suggestive of further development. You can define cross differential algebras, you know, no problem. And Bowers and Tonks have actually used these in some loop space things. And they have a good homotopy theory because there's a cylinder object, homotopy co-limits, because there's a nice model of the unit interval, which is this basic groupoid I. So there's some advantages in using cross complexes. And in fact, in comparison with chain complexes, we can do some calculations in using cross complexes, which I really don't know how to do using chain complexes, which is quite interesting, because the cross complexes, you can put more information. In particular, you can put information about a presentation of a group, which is rather difficult to insert into a chain complex. Right, so why should we talk about cubical omega groupoids with connection? Well, one of the things is they're equivalent to cross complexes. That's actually a hard algebraic theorem. The kind of techniques that were used in that were a kind of model for a recent paper with Richard Steiner, who did the equivalence between cubical omega categories with connection and infinity globular omega categories. But the work with Steiner is certainly much harder. There's some really clever things that Richard did in that. But it's a kind of nice model. You have to do folding operations. Another point is that because we've got this equivalence of categories, to define the monoidal closed structure is actually much easier to define cubically. It's almost sort of, it's almost obvious because cubes satisfy this basic rule, which Bill commented very nicely on. You know, IM cross IN is IM plus N. And when you say what's the function space in the cubical category, you can just write it down. But the hard work is in saying, well, we've got this equivalence of categories. What's the formula? What are the formulae when you translate the into the closed structure in the cubical case to the cross complex? And there's a lot of work in that. And you know, the same thing applies to the infinity categories, but you can't actually really do the sums, or I can't anyway. So the monoidal closed structure is important. Now, the third thing, cubical methods allow for a simple algebraic inverse to subdivision. Now, the question is, what does that actually mean? And, one of the things I was going to write here, that crucial input to this whole development is from Chris Spencer in 1971-2. And also 2 research students, Keith Dakin and Nick Ashley. He got his thesis in 1976, and his in 1978. came up with absolutely clear, beautiful ideas, you know, which were crucial in this whole development. And I should also say that hovering over the whole project is the spirit of Henry Whitehead. right, so that's another. But what about this algebraic inverse to subdivision? Well, the whole of this project was motivated by starting in dimension one and saying we've got the Van Kampen theorem for the fundamental groupoid. And there were two pictures which you need in the proof of that theorem. One is you take a line and you subdivide it, and you want to say that G is equal to G1 times Gn. So most of us find this very easy. The next thing is you take a square and you subdivide it, and one of the ideas to say, well, if you can draw this, here I can write G, this is the algebra for writing G as a composite. Subdivision is for a local to global problem, gave you to go from the global to the local. The composition enables you to go back again. So if you're given a square like this, what does it mean to say that the big square is the composite of all the little squares? And if you write down the axiom for double category, it's pretty obvious. You say G is Gij. No problem whatsoever. And the final point is a key element in the proof was that any composition, a two-dimensional composition of commutative squares, is commutative. And I think everybody here will say, well, that's, you know, completely obvious. And the way you use this in proving the Van Kampen theorem for the fundamental groupoid, you take a homotopy and you subdivide it. You have to shift it around a bit. You've got A here and B here and star here and star here. When you shift over to local bits, you can find that each of these squares give you commutative squares in a groupoid. Any composite of commutative squares is groupoid. It is commutative, so the whole thing is commutative, so A equals B. That's a very sort of sketchy idea, which I'll say a bit more about later. So all you need to do to generalize the Van Kampen theorem to higher dimensions is, first of all, you need a notion of a multiple category or multiple groupoid, and you can generalize these to, say, A is AR in n dimensions, where R is some multi-index, and you say, well, that's not going to cause you any problems. And then the other thing you need to do is you say, what's a commutative cube? And that's actually, you know, one of the hardest parts of the whole thing. But certainly, you're going to want that so there we needed this idea of connections. And so the connections and the equivalence of cross complexes allow for the sophisticated notion of a commutative cube. So the funny thing is that without that equivalence, we couldn't actually define a commutative cube, which I think is interesting. One of the things I should say is, you know, where does the globular thing go? I couldn't actually make any use of globular methods. So we don't use them because we can't actually use them. so we can prove multiple compositions of commutative cubes are commutative. And another point is there's a current resurgence of cubes in combinatorics, concurrency, and algebraic topology. So I won't say any more about that. So I think I'll leave that diagram up. So the main aim of the work is colimit theorems, which give non-abelian tools for higher dimensional local to global problems, which is a nice sort of slogan. And because you can calculate certain colimits, of these functors over there, that means you can actually calculate those functors when applied to certain co-limits of spaces. So that means you can actually calculate information about second relative homotopy groups and certain other things and about modules. And I should mention that, you know, some homotopy theorists say, well, the real interest is in the homotopy groups. But I remember sitting in the train with Whitehead and Milner going down, when I was a student, going down to an LMS meeting, and Henry was saying to John Milner, he's saying, oh, to the early workers in homotopy theory, the real fascination was with the action. Interesting, because that's not part of modern, what they call modern homotopy theory, because basically they don't have any methods, real methods, for calculating the actions. And this theory, though, does give methods, you know, when it works, it gives you rather complete information about the action. There's another intuition which comes into this, which is that in homotopy theory, it's rather basic that low-dimensional things affect high dimensions. Low-dimensional identifications affect high dimensions. I can even do it with identifying vertices, and then you tend to get lots more homotopy elements in higher dimensions than you do. So if you want to talk about co-limits, then you've got to deal with structures which have structure in a range of dimension, because that's the only way you're likely to capture what happens when you glue spaces together. You know, and you get some answers, you don't get all answers, obviously. Now, there was some other point there that I was going to make. You should have structures in a range of dimensions, but maybe I'll just leave it with that. So I've tried to formulate this so that it has some relation to what little I know about descent. So that's what I'll do. Because another motivation, we've had some talks about the fundamental groupoid. So obviously they say, well, what happens in higher dimensions? But in fact, the basic question, you know, having decided that groupoids were good for one-dimensional homotopy theory, then you ask yourself, are they relevant to higher-dimensional homotopy theory or irrelevant? You know? And there are two extreme answers, and you want to know which of these is true. Okay. So we suppose, given an open cover U lambda of X, and so this defines a map from there to there, and so you can form an augmented simplicial space where the higher dimensional terms involve disjoint unions of multiple intersections of the U lambda. Now, if you've got a filtered situation, let's just stick it on at the bottom of this. Then you get a corresponding diagram in which you've got lots of stars. So because you've got lots of stars, you can actually apply rho to that diagram. And so a little bit of that is this diagram. And what we want to say is that under certain connectivity conditions, which I won't have time to explain in detail, but, you know, this is a co-equalizer diagram. So that means that you can calculate this in terms of this information, namely the rows in terms of the little bits. The connectivity conditions are satisfied by the skeletal filtration of a CW complex, and so you can calculate the rho or the pi of the union of CW complexes. And that's actually quite useful to get information about free cross resolutions, and that's something we've actually used. What else should I say? Oh, because the point is here that because of the equivalence I stated before, because you've got a co-equalizer diagram for rho, you've got a co-equalizer diagram for the cost complexes. and that enables you to compute these cross complexes, which were much smaller. And this whole business of big and small was again part of the original game, because I first wrote out a proof of the Van Kampen theorem for the fundamental groupoid of U union V. I said, oh, this is wonderful, you don't need base points, you know, throw in these lucky base points, you know. And it was quite a while before I realized that, well, that's not quite right, because if you want to do the fundamental group of S1, the circle, which was the basic thing, you actually want to cut that big thing down to a small thing, and then you want to take two base points. And so eventually came up with the idea the key point was not to go to one base point or everything, but to choose your set of base points conveniently according to the geometric situation at hand. And that enabled you actually to do sums that you really wanted to do. So that's why the x0 is there, because x0 need not be a point, it need not be the whole of x1. And here we're saying, well, really, we can prove theorems with rho, but we want to cut it down to something we can actually calculate with. So you use the pi for calculations and the rho for formulating and proving theorems, which is sort of quite a good kind of game. So now, what I really want to talk about is some facts about rho, because there are some tricks in defining rho, which I think are rather fun, and how you get rho for a filtered space. So now we'll go on to here. So right. So if you've got a filtered space, X star, you might as well look at the N cube with its Dandel skeletal filtration. You then get a relative cubical singular, or filtered cubical singular complex, by just taking the filter topological maps from IN star to X star. And you try to write down all the structure it has, and it's obviously got face maps, degeneracy maps, they're fairly traditional. I'll come back to the connections. The compositions are really nicely defined. You just glue together cubes in the ith direction, you know, using the standard kind of trick. You've got an inversion. The connections are one of the things that we were forced to do in this theory, coming from initial work in two dimensions with Chris Spencer. And the original workers in cubes never realized that actually there's a nice, two nice monoid structures on I squared, on I, namely max and min. So if you put those in, they define extra kind of degeneracies, and from the geometric point of view, in simplicial complexes, degenerate simplices have two adjacent faces. Part of the problem with cubes is that degenerate cubes have opposite faces the same. That makes a kind of awkwardness. If you put in the connections, then the connections have adjacent cubes, adjacent faces of the connections are the same. So it's a bit nearer to the simplicial case. And what I can't do here is sensibly, I think, is write down all the rules. But there's a nice curious rule in connection with the connections and composition, which what I like to describe is, if you're going to two dimensions from one of the differences between two dimensions and one, in one dimension you can go forward, you can stop, and you can turn back. In two dimensions you can also turn left and turn right, which is much more interesting. And in three and a higher dimensions you do more of those. And one of the rules for the connections and the compositions I like to describe by saying that turning left with your arm outstretched is the same as turning left. I can't actually explain that now. Right. So now, you've got all the structure, and of course you have to write down all the rules, but they're sort of the obvious ones that anybody would think of. Now, one of the points is that in that equivalence of categories I mentioned, of course, every one of those rules has to be used at some place or another. Because if they weren't, then you could omit one of them. And so that's why it's a tremendous algebraic job. There's no way it could have been done without Philip Higgins, you know, is what I'm saying. A tremendous algebraist. I saw him just recently to talk about this book project. He said he was really pleased with this paper, The Algebra of Cubes. And so it was one of the best things that he'd ever done. Okay, so how do you get rho? Well, you do the obvious thing. You get rho from R by just taking filter homotopic, i.e. through filtered maps, but then there's a very clear point you have to be careful about relative to the vertices of IN, which is a bit different from what we said in our papers, but it turns out to work very well. So the definition of rho is kind of obvious as a set, or as a cubical set with connections. So it's very clear that all the cubical structure, including the connections, is inherited by rho. So the amazing thing, which took a long time to do, two things. The compositions on R are inherited by rho to give it the structure of cubical multiple groupoid with connections. And actually, I'd like to do a picture for the case of dimension 2. So you take two squares, and this was the amazing thing. And we first got going on this. We said we really want a functor from some relative situation to double groupoids, and it should involve squares. And then you say, well, what's the obvious thing? Well, you say, well, I map the vertices into X0, the edges into X1, and the whole thing into X2. Yeah. Then you say, well, what about the compositions? Well, you can compose the class of this with the class of this if and only if there's a homotopy there. And this is star. This is star. So you define alpha circle 2 beta is the class of alpha circle 2 H. Oh, dear. equals the class of alpha circle 2 H circle 2 beta. And the H is quite arbitrary. And then you have to draw another diagram. And you have to fill in that. Those are defined. I'm drawing this very badly. But the crucial point is you've got this. This is H dash. You've got this hole in the middle. And the whole point is because the homotopy is a rel base point, all of these edges are constant. So you can fill in the bottom square with a constant square, and you can push in from the top, and that's how you get the homotopy from this to this. And what was really tricky was doing the same thing in n dimensions, because you have to do some kind of filling argument. Now, the second point is the map from Rx to rho x star is a Kahn's vibration of cubical sets. I hope everybody's familiar with this idea. It means that a mapping of a box into this lifts to, if you're given a map of a cube, n cube into that, and a box down here, since they agree, then you can lift the map from the n cube into the total thing, so they all fit together. And I say this is almost unbelievable. I have evidence for that, because when I gave a talk in Paris, Bob Thomason was in the audience. He said he didn't believe it. so it's quite pleasing to have somebody of the quality of Bob saying he didn't believe it. So actually what I want to do is explain some of the ideas between behind proving that, because they may be useful possibly in other things. Anyway, I quite like them. But let me first of all give an application of that result, which explains why it's absolutely essential tool. Actually, there's a stronger version than what I've stated, is an essential tool in the theory. And what we're saying, here we've got R of X star, here we've got rho of X star, here we've got this map P. I'm saying, suppose I have a multiple composition, alpha equals alpha R down here. let's say in dimension n. So these are classes of things, and when you say this multiple composition is well defined, what you mean is that these things agrees with the adjacent ones, but of course that means you can choose representatives and there are homotopies which make sure that this thing is well defined. So say this composition is well defined, there are lots of homotopies hidden behind it. To say that this lifts to an honest composition means that you can choose representatives of all of these so that they actually agree and map down there. So in this looks almost impossible to do because you've got to use all the information about all of these homotopies to say how you actually produce these elements from the ones you've actually chosen. But with this confibration thing, it turns out to be dead easy, because your multiple composition can be represented by a simplicial cubical complex K. So you think, say, well, we're dividing our cube into lots of little bits, so that defines your cubical complex, and your multiple composition can easily be represented by a map of K into there. But now, here we introduce this new idea, K collapses down to a point. That means you can collapse this complex in a systematic, as systematically as you like, down to a single vertex. Therefore, the Kahn condition says that that lifts. End of proof. So this is this notion of collapsing. Which was due to Henry Whitehead, and so I have to explain a little bit more about this. You have to explain collapsing. Okay. So let C contained in B be subcomplexes. The key point, which I actually had from Terry Wall, not surprisingly, is about having a free face. So the picture in dimension two, if you've got a complex, big complex, B, and here you've got a little square with this free face, then collapsing in the first instance removes that bit. Right? You've got the free face. And then, so that's an elementary collapse, and then you can get a chain of elementary collapses, and that gives you a collapse. So it's a nice geometric concept. And one of the pictures is that, and fairly standard in homotopy theory, is that if B is a subcomplex, no, if C is a subcomplex of B, then B cross I collapses down to B cross naught union C cross I. That's proved by induction on the cells. And you can deduce from that that IN collapses to any one of its vertices. And that's easily proved by induction on the first step. Right. Now we need another idea. Because when you look at how you're going to prove this confibration condition, you find you've got something defined on one particular cube, and you've got these homotopies defined on bits of it. You need to do some kind of induction on these. And that turns out to be nicely covered by the idea of a partial box. So can people see that? Yeah, let C be an R cell in the N cube. Two R minus one faces are called opposite if they don't meet. A partial box is a subcomplex generated by one R minus one face, called a base, and another, possibly zero, of R minus one faces, none of which is opposite to the base. So your picture is what you would expect. Yeah, that's a partial box. So if you're trying to prove these kinds of things, you stare at that picture very often, right? Okay. So it's a box if you've got everything except one R minus one face. So the proof of the vibration theorem uses a filter homotopy extension property, which is quite easy to formulate and prove. And one of the nice things I thought about doing all this was that in the proofs, you need to check certain filtration preserving properties, and things fit exactly, right? There's no room available, but you just the right amount of room to carry out the proofs. So that's sort of suggestive that one is doing the right theorem thing. So that's, I think everybody can remember that. So if I can find my slide, there's a nice formal lemma or proposition, which is that suppose you take two partial boxes in an R cell, so they're composed of R minus one cells, and one of them, B dash, is contained in the B. Then there is a chain of partial boxes from one to the other. Each is a partial box, and you get from one to the next by just adding another R minus one cell, and also you get this collapsing property, which is what we need to prove the Kahn vibration condition. And the proof is quite neat, but I don't know, I found it sort of slippery. You say it's sort of obvious. And when you try and write that down, it doesn't quite come out right. The method of choosing these partial boxes, you see, when you look at the picture, you can see if you had another partial box, if you missed out two of these, how do you get to that? Well, there are various orders of doing it, you know, and all of those kinds of choices. And this method of choosing chains of partial boxes, and as long as you check in the proof of the vibration theorem, when you start with a partial box, and when you come to another stage, you've got another partial box, so therefore you've got a chain in between them, and you can do it up all that stage. And in the end, the proof of the vibration theorem occupies about two pages, including the proof of this proposition. Right? So with these kind of tools, it's actually quite neat. And that's actually one of the things that I wanted to say, just in case this kind of generalized tool was actually useful in other kinds of areas where multiple category theory is done. Because one of the points about this is that you don't do the proofs in the fitting arguments in the object, you do them in the models. And that means you don't need to look at the algebra, you do them in the models and then apply it. And this is quite a handy technique. And so the question is, you know, how can one apply that elsewhere? So these chains of partial box, maybe they should be thought of as generalizing free arguments. Well, I'm gradually running out of time, but I hope I've said some things which are useful. So I think, let me just mention this definition of thin. A thin element, if you have a map from IN to X star which reduces dimension filtration, then it's called thin. You have the notion of an algebraically thin element, which is defined in terms of the compositions, and then the whole thing is a proof. You have to work these two things together. And the use of these thin elements is the way you generalize the proof of use of the commutative cube. Let me just put up this diagram, because you want to prove this is a co-equalizer. So this is where you use the algebraic inverse subdivision. You take something here, you subdivide it a lot to take account of the subsets, and then you have to deform those little bits so they actually preserve the filtration, and that's where the conductivity conditions come in. Then you can put it up here, then you can move it over there, and then you can put it together over there. So here you need subdivision to go from here to here, and here you need the algebraic inverse to subdivision. So to prove a coequalizer theorem, you need algebraic inverses to subdivision. And the part of the point is that in the end, you are computing non-commutative objects. And there's some kind of sketch, which I can't do now. But let me... I tend to talk too much. So there's some crucial final oversights. I think it's modeling the geometry is crucial. Thin elements are crucial. Now, here's the amazing thing. Co-limit theorems give exact information even in higher dimensional problems relating many dimensions. And what struck me with the fundamental groupoid was that this was contrary to all the traditions of homological algebra, where you should get exact sequences. And exact sequences give you information only up to extensions. And here, you're actually, in some situations, computing co-limits, which are exact answers, not up to extension, in non-commutative situations. And the implication, you know, it would be nice if one could do this in other areas where homological or homotopical algebra could be are used. That sometimes you may actually need a co-limit theorem which will give you the answer. I mean, normally you don't know whether you're getting Z2 plus Z2 or Z4. And here, even in these non-abelian situations, you're saying this is the exact group. one construction inspired by this work when talking to Lode was a non-abelian tensor product of groups. That uses squares in non-linear methods. That's had a bibliography of 75 papers since it was defined with Lode. Globular methods don't fit easily into the scheme. Also, for computations, we really need strict structures because we want to compute co-limits. And I'm not very good at computing computing homotopy words, if you like. But maybe that's for the future. but we actually do need to compute homotopy co-limits, and that's where the nice homotopy theory fits in. In fact, there's a nice point, is that even if you want to compute groups, it might actually want to compute homotopy co-limits, homotopy pushouts of groups. And one of my favorite examples is the trefoil group, which is a nice amalgamated sum, you know, generated xy with x squared equals y cubed. Very easy to write an amalgamated sum of groups. Actually, to do computations, I actually want to regard the co-limit as a groupoid, as a homotopy co-limit, which is a groupoid with two elements. And one of the reasons for that is I put in this presentation of the trefoil group into Baumslag's Magnus program and didn't like it, wouldn't do anything with it. But if you do it in terms of a groupoid, you need to do two calculations. One is you need to calculate a set of representatives of 2z in z, and 3z in z, which I think most of us can just about manage. And then you do. So even for groups, you really need groupoids to analyze some of these presentations. Anyway, I'll stop there.